Rabbi Shlomo Zakir, Thanksgiving, first day of Hanukkah, 2013. Where does holiness come from? Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's approach to Kedusha.
Good morning, everyone. First, I wanted to thank Dr. Zitter for organizing this year and his always tireless efforts at organizing the legal holiday year. I certainly benefited from many legal holiday year back when I lived in Teaneck. Thank you again to him, and thank you everyone for coming. That's certainly a busy day. You have to have both Thanksgiving and Hanukkah somehow on the same day, so it's appreciated. So we're going to talk today about Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach to Kedusha, focusing on the question of where holiness comes from. We'll get into more details about what that question really means. But let's start off with, I guess, a general question about Kedusha, which is, what does a Kedusha apply to? What or who, what things, etc. What can be kadosh? Right? What categories are there, in a sense? Anyone have any thoughts? Everything meaning?
Well, that's a pretty inclusive term.
Well, how would you categorize? What were the basic categories of Kedusha, I guess? How would you?
People, places, time.
Right, no, that's definitely three of them. People, places, time. There's also things, right? So people, you have certain, let's say Kohanim have a certain level of Kedusha. Every Yisrael has a certain level of Kedusha. You have places, what?
Land,
places. You have the Eretz Yisrael, you have the Mikdash, etc. Time, we have things like Shabbos and Yom Tov. Ironically, today we're celebrating two different things that each of which does not have a real Kedusha. Thanksgiving, for obvious reasons, but Chanukah also, there's no Kedusha Hayom, or at least the way it's generally understood. We may get to that in a bit. So we have time, right, things. You can give something to Hekdesh, right? You can take a chair and theoretically say you're donating it to the Mikdash's treasury. Or you can take an animal and try to bring it as a karban, and then that attains a certain level of kedusha. And I think the last one, last but certainly not least, Rishon ve'in Rishis the Rishiso, is that Hashem is kadosh, right? So actually, that's source number one here, but it actually talks about the relationship between Hashem's kedusha and that of other things. Da'bera kol adas b'nei Yisrael da'marta lehem kedoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani Hashem elokeichem. Right, speak to the Jewish people, say you should be kadosh, you should be holy, because I, Hashem, am holy. Right, so there's some relationship between Hashem's kedusha and the kedusha that we are supposed to have as people, and maybe we'll see. There's we'll try to figure out the framework of the relationship between God's holiness and the holiness of everything else, of the rest of the system. Before we get into to our primary question, where holiness comes from, we're going to have to try to figure out what God's holiness means and what it means in itself, what it means for us as trying to relate to it. So if you want to talk about holiness and you're talking about, let's say, the Rav or someone in the 20th century, basically everyone's read this work called The Idea of the Holy, by Rudolf Otto. That was he was a German scholar, and he published this book. And given that everyone in the good old days was a neo-Kantian and was part of the reading everything coming out of the Marburg School, this was really the work that everyone. We'll see. If we have time at the end, other people also were significantly influenced by it. This is just one line, but there's a lot more, and try to point to other places where his approach is seen in the Rav's writings. But this is probably, if you boil down his approach to one line, it would be that holiness is a non-rational, non-sensory experience or feeling whose primary and immediate object is outside the self. We're talking about the numinous nature, the foreign nature of God and of the holy. That holiness is something that we can't really understand at all, and he really, not only can we not understand, we shouldn't really even try. He attacks rationalist efforts of trying to understand God and the nature of God and all these things. It's really something wholly other, wholly WH. That's at least the English translation, the standard translation of what of what holiness is. A convenient pun also. But right, the holy is something that's totally other than what we can conceptualize and understand, something totally foreign. And that's what it means, that God is holy. God is wholly other, is in a totally different realm, unascertainable.
That first auto comment, there doesn't seem to be so much a definition as a description of circumstances, attributes. I'm partly, I imagine, prejudiced by various things from my own.
Right.
Am I right that...
This line at least says that, and as I was trying to boil things down, maybe I could have picked a different line that was better. But even, you know, the way he's framing it as, well, he's talking about the experience, but, you know, elsewhere he talks about really the nature of holiness itself, that we really have no access to it, no understanding of it. The best we can do is talk about our experience of it, and even our experience of it should not only can we not understand it, but our experience of it when we do have an experience should be that of something completely foreign.
I'm not mistaken, or does this fill in the blanks a different way? That's Rambam's description of God.
In a sense, but the right. It's, I mean, you see the negative attributes right here, right? Non-rational, non-sensory.
Yeah.
In a sense, but it's coming out of a different philosophical framework. The Rambam was coming out of a framework where one could intuit a prime mover based on philosophy, whereas this approach, you can't really understand anything. That's the whole, you know, after Kant, we don't really know anything, and everything is sort of trying to reconstruct our perspective. So it's coming from different places, and I think there are other ramifications. I don't think we have time to get so bogged down by the auto. It's more of a, you know, setting the framework goal.
Okay.
And, you know, notably, we'll see the Rav, well, I mean, I don't know if we have a citation. The Rav quotes auto. I don't know if the Rav really quotes the Rambam anywhere when talking about holiness. That's just interesting in terms of framing things, where he often quotes the Rambam in other matters. But I don't think, you know, so this was certainly very much on his mind. So it's important to see it. And we'll see some of these next couple sources. He's really responding to that idea. So source number three here. This is the Rav in Halach Man, and you know, just the there's several different works of the Rav that are quoted here, both the, you know, the philosophical works, the halachic works, and some of his I guess you could call popular works, the ones that he's published in the last 10 years or so, posthumously. And so this is from Halach Man. So that, you know, in a sense, this may have more authority, so to speak, because it was, you know, published by him. The translation was overseen by the Rav. So the Rav writes, holiness, according to the outlook of halacha, denotes the appearance of a mysterious transcendence in the midst of our concrete world, the descent of God, whom no thought can grasp, onto Mount Sinai, the bending down of a hidden and concealed world and lowering it onto the face of reality. So it seems like the Rav is presuming that God, right, God who no thought can grasp, God is something that's really not understandable. God is a being that's not understandable, but somehow holiness allows God to enter our world, to descend, as if that were possible, right, in the scare quotes, descend onto our world, and somehow we have some access to him. And he spells it out more in some of his other writings, source number four here. The mere attributes of kadosh, kadosh, kadosh denote distance, separation, and distinction. Right? That's, you know, an approximation of the auto side of things. But then the Rav has a twist. When we proclaim in Kedusha, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory, we discover God in our ontic awareness. Right? Ontic meaning like of the world. Our awareness of the world as it is, somehow we discover God. Sum ergo Deus est. Since we exist, we find at the very root of our existence God, who is being par excellence. Of course, God is also distant. He is holy, meaning distant, and yet this remoteness does not somehow negate our existential experience. So what's his move? His move is that, it's true, you know, kuli alma lo pligi, Otto's right, that, you know, overstating this a bit here, but Otto's right, God is mysterious and distant, but somehow still, the idea of holiness we have is one that can somehow enter our world anyways. And how does it enter our world? Our existential experience, right? We're accessing God through our own experience of the divine, right? Meaning there's no, you know, it's sort of coming from us in a sense, if that were possible, rather than from above, right? That's a way of getting around the problem. We can't experience, you know, this is Kant's problem. The world as it is, how do we understand that we're limited in our perspective? So the way we access all these numinous phenomena is by is numinous, meaning like the realm of the holy other, the completely not understandable, a term coined by Otto. How do we access that? It's our existential experience. Somehow, from ourselves, we can see Hashem in the world. And this is something the Rav's written about in a couple of different places. This is, you know, here are really three formulations. Let's take a look at source number 5. Maybe, you know, the Kasa HaShlishi can further clarify things a bit. The beauty of God is experienced as holiness, as the mysterium magnum, ineffable and unattainable, awesome and holy, no Ravi Kadosh, as something that transcends everything comprehensible and speakable, which makes one tremble and also experience bliss. Beauty and paradox merge. He is both remote and so near, awesome and lovely, fascinating and daunting, majestic and tender, comforting and frightening, familiar and alien, the beyond of creation and its very essence. Right, the Rav's trying to play up this what he calls a paradox between God's remoteness and his integration with the world. The greatest vision of beauty occurs when man encounters the Kadosh, the Holy, who can neither be seen nor approached nor controlled, and yet is experienced as the root of everything. Again, the focus on experience. God is foreign, but somehow man can experience God as central. Experiencing the infinite goodness of God as beautiful means to encounter him not as a mystery defying all rules of orderliness, eluding the grasp of the necessary and lawful and harmonious. Caritas Dei, caritas like the word for charity, meaning like good deeds, inspires, ennobles, and befriends man. God is known to and intimate with him. There is no attempt to flee him, since the experience is not numinous. It is not wholly other, to use Otto's characterization of the numinous. Man tries to imitate God, walk in his way, and participate in his caritas. Right, so he really he's pushing back. He's taking a lot of Otto's assumptions, but he's pushing back against them. True, God really is foreign, but our goal is to both comprehend, maybe even apprehend God in our experience, and then to take that experience and channel ourselves forward, right? To walk in His way. Ve'alachta b'drachav. That's the idea of holiness. So. I think this is an important frame. It doesn't speak exactly to the primary question we're going to deal with, of where holiness comes from, but it's sort of the precursor to that question. Before we ask the source of holiness, we have to ask about what the relationship is between God's holiness and our holiness, right? Kedoshim to you, ki kadosh ani Hashem. Hashem is holy, therefore we're supposed to be holy. So the way the Rav looks at it, it's somehow we have to experience Hashem in the world. That's the idea of holiness, both being God's foreignness, but also somehow his involvement, his imminence with an A in the world. And that's supposed to channel us forward to be holy. So it's an important first point that I think it's especially the part that that the holiness is really experiential. Right? It's not like there's some... it's really coming from man. This is a somewhat anthropocentric account, right? It's really coming from us rather than coming from above. We're experiencing God, but it's really our experience, right? That's in all three of these last sources. It seems like the Rav was emphasizing that. So with that, and you know, I think this will help explain what follows. But even if it was a little confusing, I think what follows can be understood independently. Yeah.
It seems to me you just blurred the difference between God's holiness and our attempt to understand God's holiness.
I think the Rav was doing that. Because we can't really understand God's holiness in itself. What does that mean if we're speaking objectively? So what we can do...
But I'm trying to nail the difference between... We can try to understand it. That's how we try to understand it. That doesn't define it.
Right. Fair enough. So I think if you ask the Rav, I can't really speak for the Rav, but I would guess that he would say, you know, in Achinami, we can't really define it, and that's why, you know, the Rav is
we're
talk about
trying to understand it, can't define it.
Right. That's, you know, this is what we have to talk about. Yeah.
How close is this to a mystical conception? Obviously, you know, Rav Kook or somebody like that comes to mind. Is God something that's found within the person? Is that how he knows it existentially? Or, I mean, or is it something that the person sees in the world? So how close is this to a type of mystical way of looking at it?
So, in terms of the mystical question, we're primarily going to engage that when talking about the question where holiness comes from in really just a minute. I don't think it has to be mystical. I think you could have a mystical approach that you know, that God is really in the world. It's not about our experience. And I think, let's say in the contemporary world, more people are existentialists than 500 years ago. I think it really reflects philosophical trends, and really Kant more than other things. But I'm not. Meaning, I don't know if mysticism has to correlate to a particular conception of how we relate to God. I mean, I don't know. It's certainly not the central point here, and I haven't looked into it sufficiently to really comment. But that would be my guess. We will certainly think about mysticism and Chassidut and other approaches in just a minute. On the primary question. So working with this idea now that the Rav is focusing on holiness as and the God experience as primarily existential, and man's experience of God is the central point in apprehending God, and that's what holiness really is. So now let's move to our question of where holiness comes from. And before we do that, there's a certain conceptual introduction I think that we need, which is when you this is like sort of philosophy of language. When you talk about attributes, certain attributes in general, right? We say something's holy. That means it has the attribute of holiness, right? The word holy is an adjective, right? So whenever we talk about attributes, they can either be essential or accidental. Meaning, let's say I have a green ball, right? So the greenness of the ball, one might say, is not essential, right? It's still a ball if it weren't green. Whereas the roundness of the ball, at least some degree of roundness, is that's sorry, did I say I may have misspoken? I got it right. Yes, the roundness of the ball, on the other hand, is essential, right? If you had a ball that wasn't round, it wouldn't be much of a ball, right? Or I guess Roy Adler would say, if your grandmother had wheels, she'd be a baby carriage or something.
Trolley,
I think it's trolley car. I think Roy Adler says baby carriage.
That's different.
So you know, there are certain things that are essential definitions. To being a grandmother, I guess one of them is not having wheels. I'm not sure, but right. So the point is there are essential characteristics and accidental characteristics. So the question is, if something is holy, right? How do we look at that? Is that holiness somehow essential? Does it really define the nature of the essence of that item, or is it really an accidental attribute that can sort of, something can have holiness, something can not have holiness, and it's less essentially defined. With that framing question and knowing what we've just read, let's try to move forward and see how we can answer this question within the Rav's thought. So, source number 6 here, right? The Rav's primary claim. This is also in Halachic Man. Holiness is created by man by flesh and blood. Through the power of our mouths, through verbal sanctification alone, we can create holy offerings of the temple treasury and holy offerings for the altar. This is Hektish, right? You can give a chair to the mikdash, you can give an animal as a carbon, you sanctify that with an amira, with the very statement, you can make it holy. The land of Israel became holy through conquest, Jerusalem and the temple courts through bringing 2 loaves of thanksgiving. Right, we sanctified the land, right, through kibush, and Yerushalayim and the Azara were through right, the carbon todah. It is man who sanctifies space and makes a sanctuary for his creator. Right, so I guess, you know, this is a very strong formulation. We're going to see an even stronger one in a second. But who creates Kedusha in a word? Man, right? Man creates Kedusha. And let's see, we want to know who the Rav is arguing against. See, he's very explicit, and this is, you know, one of the very helpful things. I think this next source is really the strongest formulation of his position here, and we only have it because of, it's one of the posthumous writings. Just another indication of how important those writings are. But this is an Emergence of Ethical Man. The Rav writes, for them, namely the Rishonim, the attribute of Kedusha, holiness, ascribed to the land of Israel, is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. Right, here we go. This is an essential characteristic. The land of Israel, part of its very definition, is the Kedusha. And you find that in many Rishonim. I think the Ramban may be a good case, but there are other Rishonim also. With all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. Right? You don't often see that in the Rav's writings. He's definitely making a stand here. I do not believe that it is halachically cogent. Kedusha, under a halachic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. There's no such thing as an original inherent Kedusha. That doesn't exist. It doesn't mean anything, halachically speaking. Of course, the Rav very often saw things through a halakhic prism. So saying something's not halakhically cogent is very close to saying it's not cogent for the Rav. The halakhic term, kedushat ha'aretz, the sanctity of the land, denotes the consequence of a human act, either conquest, heroic deeds, or the mere presence of the people in the land, intimacy of man and nature. That's the first and second kibush. Kedusha is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Right? Our relationship to the land, we can create the kedusha within the land. Nothing should be attributed a priori to dead matter. Objective kedusha smacks of fetishism. That's a very, very harsh formulation, and explicitly arguing with the Rishonim, just saying that kedusha is created by man. It's not inherent. It's, one could call it accidental in the sense that where you have a chair. So if I'm makdish the chair has kedusha. If I wasn't makdish the chair, it didn't. The land of Israel, if we had conquered the land of Israel, it had kedusha. If we didn't conquer the land of Israel, it wouldn't have kedusha. So I know you're all thinking, what if we had conquered the land of Uganda or something like that, right? Would it have gained kedusha? So we'll see in a couple of sources from now that there are certain limitations. The Rav is certainly not going to say that kedusha means you can do anything, right? But there are limitations. But within those limitations, what creates the kedusha is man's actions, and in that sense, the kedusha is accidental rather than essential. Yeah.
I mean, in something like Lech Lecha, Avram has to go to Eretz Yisrael, walk in there in order to infuse it. But the only reason he goes there in the first place, because God tells him it's this land and it's not any other land. Mm-hmm. So there is a certain dual aspect going on here. You say that certain things have a certain receptivity. In other words, they have the potential of having kedusha. Other things may not. If somebody decides he wants to be makdish a pig,
it goes to the Bedek HaBayis. It works.
Okay, but you wouldn't call that kedusha.
It's kedushas bedek avayis. I mean, it's sort of a little, I don't know if we'd like publicize that on like the Mikdash's website or something. pig sanctified. But technically it works. Your main point is well taken, and I think source 10 here from Mori Rabbi of Lichtenstein's on his piece on the Rav. He writes, in halacha, nothing is sacred, but man literally makes it so. Right, that's again the main point here. And here's the line that responds to Bernie's point. While the regimen of halacha provides the necessary forms, right, the framework is set by halacha, the limitations, right, you can only bring certain animals as a karban, not a pig, right, to give that point. Or you can only sanctify certain lands as Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, not Uganda. Maybe through an expanded Eretz Yisrael you could, maybe, but right, you wouldn't have Kedusha if you just conquered Uganda. It leaves to the initiative of man's creative spirit the vital task of infusing these forms with meaningful content. Right, before man did anything, there was nothing there. There was no kedusha there. There was a potential for man to do something, but that just shows that it's man who's creating the kedusha, right? Because without man, there would be no kedusha there. So the point is well taken. There are certain limitations, but it really is man who's creating the kedusha. Yeah. No, was there a question from? Yeah.
I'm just getting back to Bernie's point. I mean, I think that he's right. There has to be a command. I mean, the first number. Number 3 talks about what is holiness. It's Hashem coming down on Mount Sinai, right? So that's kind of the originating source. Yeah, man implements everything that was given, all the commands that were given there, and therefore creates the holiness. But it has to be, you're saying, within the context of halakha. The link between this is source number 3, I think, and Hashem coming down to Mount Sinai. That's sort of the original source of the holiness. Without there being some command to go to Israel, or to give a sacrifice, whatever, then there won't be, no matter what you do, there won't be any
right. But even your formulation is not the same as the Rishonim. I mean, for many Rishonim, they would say, it has nothing to do with Har Sinai. Eretz Yisrael is kadosh from its very creation, and Har Sinai, Har Sinai is a halachic event, right? And according to the way the Rav might frame it, it's a halachic event. It's about, halacha really is about the relationship between man and God. So it's about, right, it's about man, essentially, also, right? Because if Har Sinai, if there hadn't been a Har Sinai, if there hadn't been a revelation, nothing would have Kedusha, according to the Rav. So I think, yeah.
If I'm understanding this right, the difference between the Rishonim would think that, I'm using your words, I think, that the Kedusha, for instance, Eretz Yisrael, is essential. And the Rav's notion that it's accidental because it's man activated would be, I was thinking about the Rishonim, because they have support for those notions of Losokiar, that the land cannot tolerate Arayos, so the Rav would say that had we been Kovesh Uganda and been Makdish Uganda with Kedusha, that you'd have to say the same things about Uganda. It's an obscene example considering the bloodshed part. But do I have that right?
I think it would depend on what the limitations are, or you know, the way Rav Aharon puts it, the necessary forms. Do the necessary forms of the halachic system allow for...
So there may be limitations on how far you can go with this.
Right.
But the essential notion, I think, is that. There's a Rav saying it's accidental, because it's man-triggered. And those who shown him, with whom he's disagreeing, say it's a second.
It might be. I mean, that's. I was trying to set that up. It may be a stronger formulation. You know, if you wanted to, you could say it is essential. It just needs an activation. But I would agree with your characterization. I think it really does make sense.
When you say
Rav is saying that it's man who's creating the kedusha. Sorry.
When you say maybe, I'm beginning to wonder if philosophers ever will state absolutely anything.
Never.
Say absolutely.
Absolutely never. Yeah.
It's a controversial now.
Yeah. We'll have some parallel questions about how briskers ever say things that are not tzvedim, but we'll get to that later though. The parallel question. All right. So just to show one example of the formulation that the Rav is rubbing up against here. So source number 8 is a quote from Rashi, but really Rashi is quoting the Midrashim. I tried finding good Midrash quoting. It's really integrated two of them, so I just left it with Rashi. But it's from the Midrash originally. Bereshis bara, right? The first pasuk in the Torah. And a mikra is that Omer el darshin. This pasuk is saying you have to interpret it somehow. Kemosha darshu raboseinu zal b'shvil haTorah. Right? What does bereshis mean? B'shvil haTorah shenikra reshis darko. Right? It's for the Torah. It's called reshis. B'shvil Yisrael shenikru reshis tuaso. Right? The world was really created for Yisrael. Whether you understand Yisrael as the Jewish people or the land of Israel, we see that there is a certain essential nature of right. It sounds like there's an essential nature to Yisrael, that the world was created for Yisrael. It's not just because there was a revelation that the Jewish people are chosen, or just because there was Kedushas Haaretz. But it sounds like there's something deeper there. Now you could get around that. You could say that the world was created with the intent to later give Israel the option, or give the land of Israel potential to become Kadosh. But it sounds like there's something more essential here. Another source one could point to is, let's say, the it's Machlokes for Riochan Reish Lakish and the Gemara and Zvachim about whether the land of Israel had the Mabul or not, right? So right, it didn't have the Mabul, so why not? We can say, well, it's geographically superior. You give all these explanations. It's that whatever you say, there's going to be something essential about the land of Israel, that before there was any Kedusha, before even right Gemara and Bava Kama, before even Avram walked the land, as Bernie pointed to, it still had some special status, which meant that the Mabul did not affect it. According to that opinion, those are a couple of sources from Chazal. There's a bunch of sources in Rishonim. You think about the Kuzari, the Ramban, things like that. And the Rav is explicitly saying that he is rejecting, or at least tempering, that stream, and he's taking a different approach, one that says that the kedusha is not inherent. Yeah, that's
How would this not inherent kedusha be related to the Torah?
Well, the Torah, I think, it goes back to Rav Aharon's quote number 10. The Torah creates the forms. The Torah creates the structure within which kedusha can function. And really, kedusha is meaningless without halacha, right? This is the Rav's point, right? That what is it? If kedusha is man-made, so and man's what man makes is based on halacha. So what would kedusha mean otherwise? In common parlance, you say, oh, so and so is such and such is a holy thing, or you know, the day was so holy. So the Rav says, what does it mean that it's holy? Is there this? Let's say Hanukkah. Oh, Hanukkah is a holy day. Is there so much kedusha of Hanukkah? Well, is there an Isser Malacha? There's no Isser Malacha. So what's the kedusha? What's the kedusha of Hanukkah? There's no holiness. Holiness means halacha. Kedusha has to correlate to a halachic din, and if there's no correlation, there's no kedusha. Why halacha? Because halacha is about man's relationship with God, right? And so what does it mean that you give an animal to the mikdash? You sanctify an animal to the mikdash. The animal is holy because it has certain dinim relevant to the mikdash. How you have to treat the animal. Let's say the land of Israel is holy. What does it mean it's holy? It means that there's dinim of Truma and Meiser, etc., that don't apply in Chutz La'aretz. So that was really the Rav's idea, and it's a very strong point. That's why he always frames it as halachic. So, yeah.
And also, how about, like, the script of the Torah? You're not allowed to change it because it said that that's, like, holy.
Well, a Sefer Torah has a din of Kedusha. Why? Because it has certain halachic dinim applied to it. To say, I don't know, what would it mean to say that the script of the Torah is holy? You could say it's not subject to change. Right, the Rambam's Ikar, but I don't know if that. I don't know if the Rambam would call
like,
that
if you would
holiness.
If you would write down the Torah just like line by line, then also then okay, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, yeah.
Could a Gentile create Kedusha, assuming he's not giving something to the Beis HaMikdash, and not giving something to some kind of Jewish entity? Is it possible for a Gentile who's never seen a Jew or doesn't know anything about Jews to engage or do anything with Kedusha?
A non-Jew can be makdish an animal and bring it as a karban on a bama. That has nothing to do with the mikdash. Has nothing to do with Jews. It's kedusha. So I think we'll hear Dr. Zer's point in a second. But I think the answer would be yes. I think it's more limited because halacha is not really a framework that applies to non-Jews as much. So there's just a limitation by definition. But there are some cases, and I wouldn't rule out hekdesh, karbanos. I wouldn't rule out karbanos. It doesn't even have to relate to the mikdash. So I think it's just a question of how far halacha applies. Did you want to suggest something?
I want to suggest you answer the last question.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah.
How does the Rav account for the idea of a sacred people, which he?
Okay, so we'll get to that. Yeah. Okay, you're asking the right questions, but I didn't plant anything here.
We believe.
Source number 9, we're not going to read this inside, but one interesting, it's an interesting point, and it raises certain interesting issues, that the Rav focuses the idea of Kedusha in the context of physical activity, that you can somehow worship your creator with your body, and whenever there's possibility of Isser, there's the enjoining of sanctity, right? So the idea of Kedusha is to not do prohibited things. So, don't eat certain things that are prohibited. Don't engage in certain sexual relationships that are prohibited. That's why his proof is the Rambam has Sefer Kedusha. So you think, oh, Sefer Kedusha, sort of Tabori like things. You say, oh, Sefer Kedusha, it's so holy, I really want to study it. And you look at it, and it's technical laws of which sexual relationships are prohibited, which animals are not kosher. And that's what Kedusha is, because this proves the Rav's point, right? That Kedusha is about halacha. So, and it's not just about halacha, but it's specifically in the context of the physical, the man sanctifies his body. So before we get the questions, what's interesting here, and it's really a double-edged sword, we just saw how the Rav rejects certain Kabbalistic notions about what Kedusha is, right, in the sense that it's not some inherent objective phenomenon, it's really a created phenomenon. At the same time, the Rav is embracing this idea, which really Hasidim talk about, that you sanctify the holy, maybe in different ways, right? Hasidim would say that the donut I ate this morning is somehow, creating, I don't know if donuts, but like, on Shabbos, at least the kugel you eat on Shabbos, things like that, I'm not sure exactly the system, how it works, but somehow that's an idea of holiness. You're raising the physical to the spiritual, taking food and using it to serve Hashem by being happy on Hanukkah, maybe. I don't know exactly if that, if Hanukkah's on the same level as a Tish or not, I'm not sure, but it's that, that's the Hasidic idea. We have something similar here with a twist. Right, we raise the physical to the level of Kedusha, but not by partaking necessarily, by refraining. So you don't do certain Isurim, that makes you holy. Right? And this partial answer to Chana's question, we'll see further answer later, but part of the idea of Kedoshim Tiyu, right, the Medrash there quoted by Rashi and Ramban, of Prushim Tiyu, to be separate, that's what it means to be holy, to separate from Isurim. The Rav embraces that and says that's what, how a person can become holy, by separating from Isurim. But it's about his involvement in the physical world with the proper limitations that man can make himself holy.
Isn't that you have Kedusha Yisrael even if you...
So we'll get to that later. Yes.
I think that the point that he's making in number 9 is how do we acquire Kedusha Sakuf? Okay, and the way you acquire Kedusha Sakuf is being careful of what you eat, what you take into that goof, what you nourish that goof, is kosher, is allowed, and whatever relations you have with that goof are permitted relations, and you elevate all these animalistic instincts by conducting yourself in a halachic way. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really what number 9 is all about. The focus is on Kedusha Sakuf.
Yeah, certainly. He's talking about how man elevates himself to Kedusha, and it's by following halacha, as you said, but in the physical sense. And this connects to other ideas of the Rav. The Rav in Halachic Man, especially, talks about how he's, whereas some thinkers, let's say the Mesilas Yesharim, take that as a foil, says, our goal in this world is to get into a good position for the next world. The Rav says, that's not the focus. The focus is this world, is living properly in this world and being kadosh in this world. So this is a similar idea of, again, the physical, the real world, but it's about refraining from certain things. And as you said, the Kedusha is like, raising one's sanctity, that's what's central here. So it's an interesting theme both here, and it connects to other points in the Rev as well. Yeah?
How about the Luchos?
We're going to get to Luchos. It's, okay, great. You asked a great question. Hopefully, if we have time, it's only on source 21. We'll hopefully get to it. But yeah, if not, I'll show it to you later. Fine. So I think we're going to skip 11 and 12. The goal of 11 and 12 was twofold. Or I guess it still is twofold. We're not going to read them inside. It's 11 responds to the Chana's point. It talks about the holiness of personal status. Well, yeah, personal status among other things. The Rav here talks about how Kedusha is related to the presence of the Shechina. The Mikdash has Kedusha when the Shechina is there. It doesn't have Kedusha when the Shechina is not there. So it sort of adds another side to the picture, and this brings us back to what we started with. That man creates Kedusha based on the halachic system, which goes back to man's relationship with God, which goes back to an existential understanding of God, and the presence of the Shechina, which also is man's awareness of God that's there, that's what Kedusha is, by sanctifying the land of the area of the Mikdash, let's say. So that brings the Shechina in, right? It's not circular it's circular in the sense that it all means the same thing, right? Meaning, the Shechina is our experience of the Shechina, right? Because we can't speak about the Shechina being anywhere. We don't really understand what that means. The Shechina is there if we experience the Shechina as being there. How do we do that? By following halacha, which is given to us at Har Sinai. And the halacha allows us to create Kedusha. So we create the Kedusha, and that allows the Shechina to come in. And that's our awareness of the Shechina is itself, having a Mikdash, creating the Kedusha's Mikdash, and functioning in it properly.
That's essentially Ramban on the nature of Kedusha. Concentric circles of increasing limited access. That fits nicely with this.
Well, no, any account of Mikdash and Kedusha is going to have to talk about the Shechina in some sense and access in some sense.
No, I meant in terms of the Rub's thing of it's all negation. I think Ramban defines it, in fact, as that limited access.
But we're not talking about limited access here.
Mikdash you are.
Well, that's the halacha. Right? You're not going to get around that. But the question is, what role that plays? For the Rav, it doesn't sound like that plays. I mean, it's a halacha. It's true, but it's the essential points here. I think are number one that man creates the kedusha of the mikdash, and number two that the kedusha of the mikdash and many other kedushos have an awareness of the divine, a shechina awareness, whatever that means. And I think what it means is that it goes back to the original point that the idea of God being holy is about man's experience of the divine. It's about an existential, it's about the existential approach. And that's
the previous point about Kedusha being...
Oh, the physical. Number nine.
It's negation of something.
Oh, okay. I thought you were... Okay.
That's what I'm talking.
Yeah, so I mentioned that. It goes back to the Medrash of Purushim to you and the Rashi Ramban. The Rav is definitely building on those points. Of Kedushim to you being Purushim to you, certainly. Yeah. Sorry, I thought I was... I'd like to get to at least some of the future, the sources on pages beyond 1 and 2, if possible.
Yeah, it's a lifetime.
Yeah. Let's read number 12 to respond to the personal sanctity issues that were raised. What is the meaning of Tzelem Elohim, of Kedushat Yisrael, the sanctity of Israel, of Kavod HaBriot, human dignity? All these ideas express one notion, that a person has only one master, the master God of Israel, and not two. Man is subject only to God. A human being is free and not subjected to any other person. Thus, the sanctity of the personality, which is identical to the sanctity of Israel, and is expressed in the exclusive sovereignty of the Creator, contradicts the institution of slavery. If one accepts God's commandments and attains inner sanctity, then one cannot be enslaved to another person. So, if the question was, what does it mean to be Kadosh? Doesn't it sound like it's an inherent notion? The Rav says, no, it's holiness. Really, all personal holinesses are more or less the same thing. Right, obviously, I have to say there's some differences in details of how halacha applies. Really, he says they're all the same thing. All these ideas express one notion. That's a very powerful point. Right? He's watering down the differences between them, and what does it really express? It expresses that one's subject only to Hashem. It's about man's relationship with God. Right? I have Kedusha. That means that the one being that has power over me is God, is no other being. And that's obviously there are other details, right? If I have, there are all sorts of ramifications of Kedusha. Kohen can serve in the Mikdash, right? But really, it's everything's on the same wavelength, and all of it expresses that a person, Kedusha means that a person has a special relationship with God he doesn't have with anyone else. And in that sense, the Rav, by sort of watering down these concepts a little bit, makes it consistent with his overall claim. Again, he's taking out the essential aspect from Kedushas Hagavra, we might say, the sanctity of the person.
So
Salam Elohim and Kavod HaBriyos is universal. It has nothing to do with Jews.
True.
It's true of everybody, of every human being.
Right, so here, that's why the Rav's not focusing on holy on halacha here. The Rav's focusing on who we're subject to. We're all subject to a higher being. It's not Hebrew National Commercial. We're all subject to Hashem, right? And Jews, non-Jews, everyone. And by he's playing down the idea of Kedushas Yisrael, per se. It's really also just expressing that notion in another way. And he's also playing down halacha, because non-Jews, right, they have Shem and Noach, but halacha is a lot less central to their God experience.
Right.
But that's what the sanctity of a person is, or if you want to call it Selam Elokim, whatever you want to call it, the Rav's saying, it doesn't matter what you call it. The point is it's about man's God relation. That's the point. And it's not really that essential in a sense. It's the simple fact that man exists in the world and is responsible to only one other being. And that's
so
what it means that man is holy.
All man serves one master.
Yes.
But it still seems that man doesn't have to do anything to enter that relationship in order to have that sanctity. We don't have to act. He has here at the end, if one accepts God's commandments and attains inner sanctity. So that does sound like people have to do something. But it still seems that the idea of Salam given to Dusha Yisrael, despite that last line, is something that just by virtue of the fact that we're subject to one master, exists. So it's not really man-created, and you don't have to do anything.
But in what sense does it exist? What does it mean that someone has Kedusha Yisrael? What does that mean? It just means that he only has one master. So is it really saying something essential about, you know, there's some status of Kedusha that inheres in a person? Or is it just saying, you're Kadosh, meaning you're free? Basically, the Rav is saying, you're saying, Kadosh means free. Because free in the sense of only, you only serve God. Your God relation is the only significant master relation you have in your life.
Isn't that an inherent characteristic? And then
in a sense, you could say that, but you wouldn't say the Kedusha is inherent here. He's really playing down the Kedusha as an inherent factor. I mean, there's always, right, it's always a fuzzy line between inherent and essential characteristic, essential and accidental characteristics. But, you know, to the extent that they're helpful here, I think this would fall on the side of accidental.
But,
yeah.
You know, isn't it? I don't know the halakha, so I might be completely wrong. But isn't it? Don't we bury someone, or if we find a dead body, you know, something buried because of Kavod HaBriyos, right? So it's inherent in that body. It has nothing to do with me, the person buried.
It's a good question.
Maybe extend Kavod to it,
right,
as a creation.
So it might be, yeah, it might be the latter point. Meaning, I don't know. I don't think the Rav talks about that in the context of Kedusha. But I think the Rav might say that, you know, as people, we have a command to treat other people well, and including, you know, the human body, even after death. And I think the Rav might say that that's the Kedusha. You know, it's not that the body has any special Kedusha. We have a mitzvah to bury other people, treat them with dignity, treat them with Kavod HaBriyos, but it's not because there's some inherent status in the body. This actually comes up, right, with organ donation. Let's say after all death, and, you know, leaving aside the brain death issue, but a lot of people say, well, you can't give organs because, you know, humans have this essential Kedusha, and even if it's going to save someone else's life, we can't ruin that Kedusha. Right? So, I don't know if the Rav's spoken on this explicitly, but the Rav's approach certainly would push in the opposite direction. That doesn't mean anything. That's certainly not true. And in the halakhic sense, meaning you definitely, Pikuach Nefesh definitely overrides that. But the idea of the Kedusha being something inherent, we have a mitzvah to treat bodies well, right? To not let a body rot overnight, right? But that doesn't mean that there's anything inherent about the human body that's special. It's about how we're enjoined to treat other people. So I think the Rav consistently is playing it down. Obviously, there, you know, you have the halakhic system. You can't get, you know, do away with halakha. This is the Rav, right? This is the Rav. But to the extent that he can interpret anything as not talking about an essential Kedusha, he does. I think that's consistent here. Yeah?
What is the way Troll is formulated not run into a problem of, if I buy an Ebekanani, I'm denying his Kedusha?
That's a separate question. You can ask that, you know, look at that chapter in Festival of Freedom. And the Rav is saying, oh, Judaism is anti-slavery, Judaism doesn't believe in slavery, so then what do you do with the existence of slavery in Judaism? That's a much larger topic.
I'm not asking you just the existence of slavery. I'm saying the way you're saying that the freedom to serve, this is all the law, why in heaven Kanani is plucked from mitzvahs,
right.
But if he's saying it denies your Kedusha, it seems to me that making an Ebekanani then denies him his Kedusha as an Adam.
Again, it's a good question. I think the question is more on anyone who takes a strong anti-slavery stance within Judaism, presumably that's many of us, is going to run into problems. I think it's.
But I'm not interested in the general notion. I'm interested in the way he's formulating it here.
So I don't. However, it won't solve the general problem. Likely, would find a way of getting this into. It's a good question. I don't know if we have time to talk about it now, but it's a fair question. Let's take a look at source 13 here. This is one of the Rav's halachic works. in Shirim Zecher Abba Mari, not written by him, but it was overseen by him, and it's based on his drasha, so it's a pretty fair presentation. This is part of a much longer piece, Kiddush K'Mekadesh HaShabbos, about the nature of Kiddush, Machlokes between the Rambam and the Ravid there, but this is like sort of the punchline, and it's important for our purposes. Nam divrei Kiddush anem Mari Malakos, Mechadshim Chalos B'Kiddushas Yom HaShabbos. Indeed, the words of Kiddush said over a cup of wine somehow create a status, they make a chalos, in the sanctity of the day of Shabbos. I mean, by making Kiddush, I am creating the status of Shabbos. Chalos ha-kedusha mishtachalas ha-yadam, v'shabbos mitachedes im mo'ed, yom ha-shvi'i im mikra'i kodesh. The status of holiness integrates through this, and, you know, Shabbos comes together with mo'ed, seventh day comes together with mikra'i kodesh, right? That's poetic language. Knesses Yisrael mishtatefes im ha-kadosh baruch hu, v'shichlul kedushas hayom, ki yom Shabbos bereshis, uchiyom tov mikra'i kodesh. Right, thereby, the Jewish people is partners with God in really creating the status of the holiness of the day. Right, because God created, right, so how does this work? God created, I mean, he gets fleshed out in more detail, we're not going to cite the whole thing. God created Shabbos on, right, the seventh day of the world's existence, and we trigger Shabbos in a sense. We somehow integrate, we partner with Hashem. Hashem created Shabbos, the Platonic form of Shabbos, one might say, and we instantiate that on our Friday night, Saturday, right? We bring it into being by making Kiddush. Making Kiddush triggers Shabbos. Now, so what we see here, this is under the category of complications because, right, really, what the Rav is saying is that there's two different there's two different partners here, right? If we are mishtatef with God, then that means that God did something and we did something. God created Shabbos and we created Shabbos, right? So there's really two different statuses, and like even within the piece, there's halachic nafkaminas of, right? But think about it. Let's say you didn't make Kiddush, and then you went and drove, or let's say lit a fire on Shabbos, right? You didn't make Kiddush on Shabbos. And then you lit a fire. So would the Rav say, well, you didn't make Kiddush, so it's not Shabbos yet, so you're not going to be chayav for lighting a fire? He's obviously not going to say that. That's against halacha. Halacha is, whether you make Kiddush or not, if you're mechallel Shabbos, you're mechallel Shabbos, and with everything that results from that. But there is a certain, one would have to say, inherent status to Shabbos in itself. But at the same time, man somehow upgrades the Shabbos level with this Kiddush. That's the Rav's whole point here in the position of the Ravid that he really pushes.
That's the difference between being a say and the law of the Shabbos.
But what does it mean that he creates that making Kiddush creates Kiddush?
That's how I hear this. The man creates the assay part of Kiddush.
What does that mean? What does it mean to have Kiddush out of
an assay? If you don't make Kiddush, mm-hmm. you're still chayav in the law. You haven't been begotten the assay.
But then what's the Kiddush that's created?
The Kiddush of the assay.
But that's
today.
Is there any meaning to the assay other than creating the kedusha of the assay, which is the assay? It's meaning. What are you adding to saying you made kiddush? What's the rav adding to saying you made kiddush? If you say, well, create the kedusha of having made kiddush. What does that mean?
Outside being the kind of the assay, I don't know if there's an answer to that.
So, but then that doesn't sound like the rav, right?
You can say that about any assay.
That's not true.
That's not true.
So, I mean, the point of the rav is here is that there are certain nafkaminas in terms of the kedushas hayom. I'm not sure what the nafkamina is, meaning there's still, right, there still is, like, if you're Mechal Shabbos, there is a Chiv Skila, no matter what, I think. I don't think you can get around that. But he is trying to say that somehow you are part of creating the Kedusha Shabbos. And there's this parallel question you can ask about Havdalah creating sort of the ending of Shabbos, in a sense. I don't want to get bogged down in the details, but I think one point that's important here is that there's two aspects here. There's a sort of inherent... right, there's inherent status to Kedusha, to Kedusha Shabbos, and there's the created aspect. Now, this is what I was mentioning before, right? That if you're a brisker, you want to say, X is always Y. Kedusha is always created by man. So, but then at the same time, you have that brisker pull to say that it's Vedinim, right? That there's two different things going on. So, like the Rav, I think part of why part of the complication here is that you can't expect the Rav to never have a Vedinim about Kedusha if he, you know. Just because he has a strong position, I'm sort of saying this in jest. But my point, more seriously, is that even though the Rav has a complication here, and the next two sources also are complications, it's clear that the main thrust of his position is that kedusha is man created, is a function of halacha. And even in cases where you would think, no, the kedusha is there, right? Shabbos, I would have thought Shabbos is a really good proof to a case where the kedusha is there to begin with, right? Yom Tov, we make Rosh Chodesh, so we decide what the Yantav is. So there you have a good argument that man created the Kedusha. Shabbos, it's Misheshes Veibreishis, right? Shabbos is Shabbos. I would have thought even there the Rav makes effort, you know, through the position of the Raven, through that this whole shir of his, he makes a real effort to emphasize the man created part of Shabbos. So I think that's how you know, that's how you the best the Rav could do, given that he has to have a Chakira. So given that, his shita on Kedusha pushed him in the direction of emphasizing the man aspect of Shabbos, though he can't deny that there's a certain inherent Kedusha Shabbos as well. We're going to skim the next two. Source number 14 sounds like a strong major complication, let's say, because it really talks about, I mean, you could say this is homiletical, but it sounds like, it really sounds like the Yom Tov and Shabbos has an actual status. The time itself has a certain status to it. And he talks about the Balei HaKabbalah, the Sabbath day is personified by the Sabbath queen. That definitely doesn't sound like the Rav we heard about until now. I'm not sure what to do with it beyond saying that the Rav was being homiletical. But it definitely seems to run against his position more broadly. Source number 15, we'll see, there's a Tzvei Dinim. This responds to Chana's point before as well. This is one of the places where the Rav writes about Korah. The cry of Korach and his followers for all the community are holy, all of them, right? Kol ha'edah kulam kedoshim. The Lord is in their midst. Why do you raise yourselves above the Lord's congregation? Is partly true and partly false. I sense a dichotomy, right? Its premise is true, but its conclusion is false. It is correct that the external exoteric holiness of the community of Israel, which obligates all of us to perform the commandments, does not distinguish between great and small. However, internal esoteric holiness is dependent on the greatness, breadth, and depth of the individual. Now here I think the Rav is really, or the greater a person, the greater his holiness. I think the Rav is really pulling off a coup here. Right, because the terms we've been using, which I think are the standard terms to use, is that, right, if you talk about, right, the Rav's talking here about a person has a certain status to them automatically. You're a Kohen, you're a Levi, you're Yisrael, you're a something. And on the one hand, on the other hand, they have this kedusha based on how they act, how big of a tzaddik they are. Let's say, right, the greater the person, the greater his holiness. So if you would call one of these essential and the other one of these esoteric, one internal and the other one external, which would be internal, which would be external? I would have thought the internal one would be the one that I was born with and had no matter what I do, right? The Rav is saying, no, turns it completely on its head. That's external. Don't bother me with your lineage. That's not so important. Don't bother me with yichas. Okay, you happen to have yichas. There's a certain status, a certain nachkaminas of that. But the inherent, the internal thing, which I think the Rav doesn't, I don't think this maps on so well to what we said before about the green ball, but internal in the sense of the more significant thing, the thing that the real point of Kedusha is how I act. Right? So I happen to be born a Kohen. Shkayach, I'm a Kohen, I can do Duchening, right? But the real question of whether I'm really Kadosh is how I act towards other people. Do I keep Halacha? Am I Poresh from Arayos? Am I Poresh from Macholos Asuros? Do I follow halacha? Am I a good halachic Jew in terms of following halacha? That's the internal question. That's the real question. So even though the Rav has this dichotomy here, again he's pushing in the direction of emphasizing man's actions and fealty to halacha, and he downplays the inherent status. That's external. That's less important. And that was Korach's problem. Korach was obsessed with status symbols. Oh, you're a Kohen. Oh, you're the leaders. That's not the point. The point is, who's the leader? The person who keeps the most mitzvot is the leader. The person who's the biggest tzaddik is the leader. And that was the point. That's what he missed about Moshe. That Moshe was the leader because he deserved it. That's the Rav's drasha here. You could take a look in more length inside. But that's really what the Rav does here. So I think that responds to Chana's point from before. That there really are these two aspects. One of them, the Rav plays down significantly. Both here he plays it down. In the previous source about Kedusha Yisrael is the same as human, as Moshe Elokim. He plays that down, and he builds up the idea of what you do, what you're keeping. We're really running out of time, so I want to just take a quick look at some of the Rav's predecessors, which is interesting. We'll take a look at that and then we'll call it a day. We'll get Herman Cohn and the Meshech Chachma. Ben Sion has to be back before we see the Meshech Chachma because he asked about the Luchos. We'll take a look at those and then we'll call it a Thanksgiving. So Herman Cohn was... The Rav actually wrote his PhD on Herman Cohn and other things on his idea of science. But it's clear the Rav was reading Herman Cohn. I don't know if you ever met him. Rav Cohen died in 1918. I assume the Rav was not into Mada when he was 15 years old yet. He read books or something, but he certainly was not in the University of Berlin. But Hermann Cohen was, what are his exact years? 1842 to 1918. He was part of the Neo-Kantian Marburg school. And fine, so let's take a look at some of his material that I think the Rav is drawing upon partially. This is in Religion of Reason. It's, I think, the only real translated selection of his works. It's a big book, but there's a lot more that's not yet translated. A great center of gravitation comes into the... on the Jewish material. I mean. A great center of gravitation comes into the world with the words, "Ye shall be holy, for I, the Eternal, your God, am holy." Right? Kedoshim to you. We saw that pasuk before. The word holy has a twofold meaning. It relates holiness to God and to man. Right? We saw that. I mean, it comes from the pasuk, but... Right, we saw in the Rav the idea of imitatio Dei being part of experiencing Dusha. And one is to assume that only through this unified relation to God as well as to man can holiness be thought of as possible with regard to God himself. As on the other hand, one might say that only through the coming to be of holiness in God does its relation to man simultaneously become possible. Okay, so, you know, notoriously difficult to read, as all German philosophers are. But he talks about a coming to be of holiness. Meaning, it's not, only through, right, somehow, well, first of all, his main point here is talking about, we'll get to the coming to be in a second, but his main point here is about the relationship between God's holiness and man's holiness. Only through man being holy is God's holiness somehow justified, or in whatever sense that means. But somehow, you have to aspire to make God's holiness become meaningful by yourself being holy. Fine, what is the difference between that which we scientifically call morality and the religious expression of holiness? What's the difference between holiness and morality, right? Because for Hermann Cohen, he came to religion later in his life. He emphasized the idea of holiness very significantly as a central tenet, if not the central tenet of Judaism. So there are also certain apologetic reasons why he sort of had to emphasize that where he was. But fine, the difference is to be derived from the difference of the tense and the verb in the sentence in which holiness is used with regard to God and man. So there's a grammatical, philosophical point he's about to make. With God, it is being, for I am holy. God is holy, right? It's a state of being. With regard to man, however, it says, ye shall be holy, right? Right? Kadosh ani Hashem, I Hashem am holy. There's no verb in the Hebrew, right? It's a status. But for man, it's to you, be holy. Hence, one may translate, ye shall become holy. Right? It's about becoming more than being. Holiness thus means for man a task, whereas for God, it designates being. So this idea of a task, of holiness for man being a task, I think is a very significant point that the Rav really draws upon, right? Because the Rav talks about man. It's not that you are holy. There's no inherent kedusha, or if there is, it's minor. The real kedusha is what you do. Are you following halakha, right? For man to be holy, are you staying away from arayos? Are you not eating macholos asuros? If so, you're becoming holy, right? And I think it's just one more step to say. And similarly, other items don't have a status. Man creates the status of holiness in them, right? So those items become holy. There's no such thing as being holy. The land of Israel, it's not that the land of Israel is holy in essence, it's that it became holy through an act of conquest or entering the land. So I think the Rav gets this idea from Hermann Cohen. Of course, the Rav shifts in the sense that for Hermann Cohen, it's really ethics and morality. That's really the center of everything. For the Rav, the center is halacha, right? Because he's the Rav. And halacha, you know, defines the Rav's hashkafa in many ways. But the idea of you know, kedoshim tiyu, ki kedosh ani Hashem, telling us that in order to relate to Hashem, what we have to do is make ourselves kadosh through our actions, that I think he's drawing on Hermann Cohen here. That's point number one in terms of predecessors. And the final point, another predecessor, I believe, of the Rav is the Meshech Chachma. Right? He lived 1846 to 1923 in Dvinsk. A certain hashkafa, Lithuanian hashkafa, one might say, is very well represented here, and he's talking about the Luchos, which we heard a question about before. So, right, so we'll try to read through it. It's really a much longer piece. I cut a few selections, but it's a very rich piece. Everyone should read it. Right, this is Moshe came to the camp. He saw the Egel. He smashed the Luchos. That's the pasuk. So, what does the Meshech Chachma say? Ha'inyan. What's the deal here? The story is. Right? The Torah and belief are the central tenets of Judaism, of right, of the Jewish nation. Kol Kedushos, all holinesses, all sanctities, Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim, v'chule, hema prateu snifei ha-Torah, v'niskadshu b'kedushas ha-Torah. All of these kedushas, the land of Israel, the Torah, those sanctities are part of the Torah. Those are sanctified through the sanctity of the Torah. What does that mean? V'lachein ein chiluk bein inyanei ha-Torah bein b'makom bein b'zman. There's no difference between all aspects of the Torah in time or place. V'hi shaveh b'eretz Yisrael v'chutz la'aretz. Right? The Torah is equal whether you're in the land of Israel or in Chutz La'aretz, right? And there are certain formulations in the Sifri quoted by the Ramban that sounds like the Torah is different in Chutz La'aretz. He's pushing back, at least in some interpretations. He's saying, no, that's not true. The Torah is equal everywhere. Whether you're Moshe Rabbeinu or you're the lowest of the low, the highest of the high, the holiest of the holy, whatever you want to say, the Torah is the same for you, no matter what. So that's the background. V'alzet savach Moshe kikruchya. This Moshe screamed out like a rooster. But the point is, he screamed out. Moshe was very upset. Ha'im tidmu ki ani inyan ve'ezer kedusha bilti mitzvos Hashem? It should be, I'm not sure, maybe a typo there. But do you think that there's no holy, that there's any holiness outside of the mitzvos? Ad ki behedir kvodi asisim lechem egel? I don't understand. I'm on Har Sinai to get the mitzvos, to get the Torah. You decide we need to create something to be holy. That you're missing the whole point. The whole point of holiness, holiness is the mitzvos. The mitzvos create the framework of holiness, right? So you're creating an egel. I'm on Har Sinai to get the Torah. You're creating an egel because you want to see kedusha. You've made the idea of kedusha into an avodah zarah. Chalila gamani ish kemochem. Or you want to replace me with some holy leader with the egel? What do you mean? I'm just a person like everyone else. About Torah, Einot Tluyah Bi. There's nothing special about me per se. There's nothing inherent about me. So don't think that. Right? Chas v'shalom to say that the mikdash has inherent sanctity. Hashem yisbarach shoreh v'sof banav. Hashem lives amongst his sons. V'im hema kadam avrubris, if they, like man, break the covenant, husar mehem kol kedusha, the kedusha goes away, right? Like what we saw here about the Rav and the Shekhinah awareness. If you sin, the Shekhinah leaves, you have no more kedusha. V'im kichli chol bo pritzim v'chileluha. This is timely, right? Bo pritzim v'chileluha, that's Karli is the Chanukah, and we sing, some of us sing uvo zarim v'mikdashi. That's also about the bo pritzim v'chileluha, about undermining the sanctity of the mikdash. Once the sanctity of the mikdash goes away, there's nothing magical that punishes people who go in. If the kedusha is gone, the kedusha is gone. The kedusha is gone when the shekhinah is gone. When you don't keep the Torah anymore, the shekhinah leaves, it loses its kedusha, and then you can do whatever you want inside. You're not violating anything because the kedusha is gone. That's his point. There's nothing inherent about the land of the mikdash. The land the mikdash is on, the building, the edifice. It's not about the edifice. It's about the Shekhinah. It's about the halachic system. It's about the Torah. V'yicharach Moshe v'yashlech mi'adam v'shaluchos. Ritzono lomar. What the pasuk again? What does it mean? Ki ein shum kedusha v'inyan eloki klal bil'adei mitzius haborei yisbarach shemo. There's no such thing as holiness or divine elements outside of the reality of God. V'im hevi'a luchos. Why are there luchos? Do the luchos have kedusha? If Moshe had brought the luchos, people would say, "Okay, we're not supposed to have an egel. We don't have a magical calf, but we should have these magical holy luchos. These stones that have holiness. That's why Moshe breaks them. Not because he's angry. Not because he's weak. He breaks them. It's an educational lesson. You think that a physical item you can have and create a calf and that's holy? Totally wrong." And to make you realize that, you might think the luchos are holy. I'm going to smash them right in front of you. Ulam kasher shavar luchos ra'u ech hema lo higiu el matras emunah ba'ashem v'terasu atahor. Then people realized how much they'd messed up, how they'd missed the point, and they did tshuva, etc. But the point is, this is the exact proof. Breaking the luchos is the proof that there's no inherent kedusha. Just like there's no inherent kedusha in the egel, there's no inherent kedusha in the luchos, and that's why Moshe had to break the luchos. So I think let's wrap up, and then we'll see if people want to hear the questions or not. But we didn't see everything. There's a lot more to see. There's some parallel. Some of the Rav's contemporaries make similar points that I think are also interesting. But we find that the Rav's approach to kedusha here. Number one, God's holiness in the sense that we can't really understand God in Himself, but our understanding of God, the holiness is our apprehension of God and following God's will, that's keeping the Torah, and that already spills over into the idea of Kedushas Adam, right? We should be holy because God is holy. Our being holy means keeping the mitzvahs, keeping the Torah in the physical world, in the, you know, refraining from certain prohibited physical activities. But then we can both sanctify ourselves. We can also sanctify objects, sanctify time, sanctify place. And it's not inherent. It's not what was originally there. It's not like the Rishonim say. The Rav is disagreeing. And it's coming from us. It's created by man. And there are many ramifications of this, some of which we saw. But really, Kedusha is created by man. It's not inherent. And you know, it's really an inspiring point. And this runs through the Rav in several places. I mean, it's both a modern point, you know, that's sort of the focus on man. You know, this is influenced by Kant. That we can't speak about the world at large. We have to sort of speak about ourselves and our experience about it. That's all we have access to. And once you know making man into the center of Kedusha and making it be a charge to man, and it ties into tshuva and it ties into all sorts of other things we didn't get a chance to see, it's really an inspiring message. And a lot of the reason why the Rav's work is inspiring is because it speaks to man himself and it charges man with doing the best he can, working to become holy, to follow the halacha. And I hope this message. This idea, the Rav's whole approach here, is inspirational to us as well. I guess if there are questions and people want to hear them, they can, or if people want to vote with their feet, they can do that too.
How about, it's in a couple of places, I don't know exactly where the exact psukim, Hashem says, I can't be completely revealed to you because then you'll die. Right, so then it doesn't seem that humans have anything to do with that. If Hashem would just appear to any man, Jewish or not Jewish,
right,
whether they did anything themselves or not, they supposedly would die.
So that's a fair point. One thing, I mean, we saw the Rav talking about the Kedusha of man, the Kedusha of items, the Kedusha of places, the Kedusha of time, and he says all that is man-created. The Rav doesn't say anywhere that God's Kedusha is man-created. That would be somewhat problematic.
It could be a very Christian.
Interesting point. In a sense, yeah. But I think what the Rav does say is that our experience of God is coming from man rather than from God. So that's it fits. It's not the same thing by any means, right? Hashem has Kedusha. We can't understand Hashem, but Hashem says he's Kadosh, so that must mean he's Kadosh. But practically what that means for us, what we can actually understand, is that our relationship to Hashem is from our experience of Hashem. And that's what allows us, gives us the power to then sanctify other things. It's through the halachic system and the revelation at Sinai that we have that we can then go and be makdish other items. Yeah, okay. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you much, Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey. Oh. Have you taken a bunch of that? They took a bunch of them.
No.